We are less than a month away from the biggest World Cup ever, right here in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. I'm Heath Pierce, former U.S. men's national team player with stops in the Bundesliga, MLS, Denmark, and Sweden. And I'm also the host of Orange Slices, sponsored by FanDuel Predicts. Orange Slices is the place to bring your World Cup memories to life. The people, the moments, and the stories that don't always make the highlight reel, but help shape everything we love about this game. Think of it as your soccer hang all summer long. Listen to Orange Slices wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome on into another episode of the Baseball Insiders. I am Robert Murray, and as you can see, this is not my usual setup. I drove 27 hours to Wisconsin this weekend, made it safe and sound. Cooper and I are here, and now I'm here with Emma Lingen, who is absolutely lovely, does a fantastic job here at fansided.com. Thrilled to be here with you, Emma. How are we doing? Happy Monday.
Well, I'm very impressed, first of all, because if I had just driven for 27 hours, I don't know that I'd be able to put a sentence together. So you're doing a lot better than I would be right now.
No, I appreciate it. I'm not kidding you. I was so worried I was going to stumble over that because I am like operating with 25% capacity, which is about normal for me. So you know what? It's like we're bouncing back pretty good today. But I'm thrilled to be here with you because we have so much to talk about in baseball today. And in addition to watching us here on the Baseball Insiders, you can catch us on fansided.com. You can catch us in the Baseball Insiders newsletter. We have a Discord where I do a weekly Q&A every Thursday from, 3 Eastern to 3:30 Eastern. We also are doing a great giveaway with Louisville Slugger where you just need to tell us why you love baseball. Like, what made you fall in love with baseball? Film a little audio recording of it, submit it, and you have a chance of winning a Louisville Slugger tour that's VIP. Can get flown out, hotel room for two. It's an incredible thing. And if you end up getting a runner-up, you get a Ronald Acuna Jr. signed bat, which is extremely cool. Again, I could not recommend more doing something like that. It's so easy, goes to a great cause, and you can win a trip of a lifetime with you and whoever you love in your life. So could not recommend it more. But Emma, we have so much to talk about. And today is the one-year anniversary of the Rafael Devers trade. Now that we're a year removed from it, what exactly are your thoughts of the trade? Did you see this coming? Like, what? I would love to know what your overall thoughts are on the situation.
Well, first of all, I mean, I feel like I should be wishing you a happy anniversary of sorts for this day. I mean, I remember this day vividly in the fan-sided universe. This was a big deal, big day for you, big day for us. But you know, I think we could all just wax nostalgic about how much none of us would have expected Devers to be traded at the time that he was. And I think that even hindsight has not changed that. But a year later, I mean, it is really difficult to argue that anyone but the Giants won this trade. I think that, you know, at the time, the package that the Red Sox got back, there was, you know, it was kind of framed as more of a, it was like a culture and a roster fit decision, as much as a baseball decision. But, you know, it seemed like they had a promising package of guys they got back. Meanwhile, the Giants got what they wanted. They had a proven middle of the order star under a long-term contract. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, if you want to point to Devers not having the best year this year, still, I think that San Francisco landed the best player in the deal by far and remains, you know, committed to him through what, 2033. Meanwhile, the Red Sox, I mean, they, what is it, Harrison and Tibbs no longer with the organization. You know, the package looks even less impactful now than it did a year ago. And even a year ago, there were questions about it. I think that it just right now, a year later, it feels like a bet by Boston that flexibility and whatever clubhouse harmony, I don't know what the word is, but a bet that all of that would outweigh talent. And so far, that bet has not paid off. So I would say a year later, the Giants still win this one for me, and it's not particularly close.
No, I'm with you on that. And it's crazy to think that it was a year ago today, and it happened on Father's Day. And now, a year later, I'm with my dad, who is a huge Giants fan. And I was actually, like, when I got the original text about the trade, or the original call, I should say, I was supposed to be talking to my dad during that, and he delayed it. He was like, I can't remember what he was doing, but the fact that he wasn't able to at that very moment may have saved me from missing, on the scoop of a lifetime. So that was really cool. And I totally agree with you. And it's crazy to think about that the second and third most impactful players from that deal are not even on either of those teams, but they're in Milwaukee and they're also with the Dodgers, because Kyle Harrison's been phenomenal with the Brewers. Him and Mizorowski are maybe the two, like, the most exciting duo in ball right now, which if you would have told me, I would have said that entering the season. I get, like, again, I was super high on both, but I never saw this coming. And then James Tibbs, the way that he started the year for the Dodgers in the farm, just incredible. So that trade was a big swing and a miss by the Red Sox. Obviously, it gave them some more financial flexibility, but they barely used it in the offseason. I've said that on numerous different podcasts. I don't need to go down that rabbit hole again, but Giants definitely came out on top there for sure. And then possibly the biggest player traded this year at the deadline is going to be possibly Tarek Skubal. Just returned. What were your initial impressions from his return, and did it meet your expectations?
I think nothing about this whole situation has met my expectations, right? I mean, like, he made his first MLB start like 38 days after elbow surgery. He touched 99. He was averaging 98 on his fastball. I mean, that's incredible. At that point, it doesn't even really matter what the results of the game or the outing was. Like, that alone is insane. I think, you know, the velocity was there. The swing and miss stuff was there. I mean, the only major mistake was the homer that he gave up. And I think that, you know, some rust is obviously going to be expected. I mean, the man just had elbow surgery 38 days ago. So I would say the encouraging part is that nothing about the outing suggested that there were any, like, lingering concerns about his health. So it seems like a best case scenario here. I think that, you know, to your earlier point, if anything, it has strengthened the trade market that was already pretty robust for Skubal. I think that, you know, rival teams now they're seeing Skubal looking like Skubal, and, you know, maybe not a buy low candidate anymore. But I think, you know, he's obviously a tremendous trade asset here if the Tigers do decide to deal him. I think the bigger storyline here, though, at least for me, is the procedure itself, nano needle that he did. Like, mm-hmm. I think that could end up being, you know, revolutionary if it is, you know, a recovery timeline that becomes repeatable. I mean, I will say, like, if I'm Cincinnati right now, I'm kind of looking at Hunter Green like, all right, like, what are we doing? So I think that this is something that could really, you know, have a much bigger impact around the game beyond just Skubal himself.
No, I think that's an excellent point by you. And it's crazy that we're even in the day and age now where you can have elbow surgery and return 38 days later. Like, I never thought that was going to ever be a possibility. And, like, let alone 38 days, that's totally bonkers. So huge credit to Neil Eletrosh. Huge credit to Skubal for both sides coming together and figuring that out and being able to put him in a position to compete. And there's going to be so many different teams who are going to be after him at the deadline. And we've talked about him for, like, a ton here, whether it's going to be the Dodgers. I don't think the Padres should end up doing something like that at this point. Just doesn't feel like the necessary splash of AJ Preller does make a big move. But if you're a team like the Brewers or the Rays, and you have a chance to go out and get him, and you see him healthy, and if he continues this, like, this is going to be something where I think teams are going to need to see it for more than one outing. So if he keeps it up for 3, 4, 5 outings and he's still healthy and performing really well, that's when things are going to get pretty serious here, and teams are going to start having some pretty serious dialogue internally, but also with the Tigers as well. So they're in a great position there, but they may have just totally changed the game when it comes to elbow procedures and potential recovery times. And the one thing we're going to have to be careful of, though, is any guy that has a procedure with their elbow or that same kind of surgery, we can't be putting them on that Skubal timeline. 38 days, like, that's pretty quick. So, like, let these guys heal at their own pace. If it takes 45 days, don't fret it too much, but still totally remarkable and may have just totally changed the entire deadline landscape with that. And as far as, like, a different part of the league here, the Milwaukee Brewers, they keep exceeding expectations here, and they do things that initially you're like, why the heck would they do that? And that was me in the offseason when they traded Caleb Durbin, and they ended up getting Kyle Harrison in that deal, and it turns out to be a huge win for them. Cooper Pratt's extension was one of those where I'm like, what the heck's going on here? Gave him 8 years, 50 plus million, and now he's getting called up to the big leagues. What are your expectations here for Pratt, And do you think that was a good move by to extend him by the Brewers?
Well, I mean, to echo your point, the Brewers are so annoying how they always do that. They always do that. And every time they make a move or a decision where you're like, what? And it always ends up working out in their favor. But, you know, credit to them. I think as far as what to expect from Pratt, I agree. I was a little taken aback. It's always risky to extend a player that early in his career. But I think, you know, he's going to come up and he's going to help primarily with his glove. I still think the bat is going to take some time. So I would just say, like, don't expect, you know, immediate, you know, pop from his bat. But, you know, I think that his numbers offensively don't really jump off the page, but they do kind of undersell a player who has been trending upward and really just kind of doing a little bit of everything. I think, again, his defense is the major selling point here. He's got, you know, really good arm, good defensive instincts. You know, I would caution again against expecting an immediate offensive star, but I think that he's a well-rounded player from everything that I see. And so I think that, you know, a realistic expectation for him as a rookie would be solid defense at shortstop. I think he'll provide competitive at bats. I think he'll have good plate discipline. I think he'll maybe have some stolen base value, maybe some like modest power. But I would definitely expect some offensive growing pains against big league pitching. But again, if you're Milwaukee, I don't think this promotion is really about making him a rookie of the year candidate necessarily. I think it's about upgrading a position that has been a weakness. And, you know, while they're getting their shortstop of the future, presumably acclimated to the majors during a playoff race. And so I think that, you know, the Brewers are betting from, I would assume that the Brewers are betting that his defense is ready now and that the bat is something that will continue to develop. So I would say if he hits like 240, 250, solid on base skills, you know, and plays good defense, I think that's already a win for Milwaukee.
No, and totally. And he's someone who they were very optimistic about what their future or what his future looked like. And they were betting on future performance there. And offensively, as you said, his numbers don't jump off the chart. He's still, even when they made the move to extend him, they knew he had a lot of growth to do offensively. They think he's done some of that. But they also think there's a lot more left in the tank that they can go out and do with him, but you can also do for himself. And getting him consistent major league at bats is going to be a pretty big thing. And he can end up really making an impact there on that clubhouse overall. And he's someone where I can see an immediate impact actually happening because it's just the numbers don't suggest it, but the Brewers always find a way where they call these guys up and he's going to provide a big upgrade over Luis Rengifo there for sure. And enjoy Ortiz potentially there as well, because they needed to do something. That was one of the most glaring weaknesses on that team overall. And if he doesn't immediately show that he can be the guy, maybe they can send him back down. They can bring in somebody at the deadline again. Like I was on a show before this, and they asked me like what the left side of the infield options look like in the market. And I'm just like, at this point, maybe CJ Abrams, but I don't see that necessarily happening. I mean, maybe like a Willie Castro type. I mean, there could be Jeremy Pena's not being discussed. They have no interest in moving him at this point. So it's tough to figure out overall. But I think if the Brewers, if they can get him up and cooking, it keeps some other prospects there at the major league level that they can maybe move for maybe a school type or maybe a different type. Okay. I'm going down this rabbit hole. Okay. Don't mind me here, but is Freddie Peralta back to the Brewers? Is that a bad thought? Like, it's something I've been thinking about. I went to the gym here this morning, I went to the gym here this afternoon, I should say. And I had someone come up to me and be like, could we actually go out and get Freddie Peralta? I'm like, I don't think so, but I also don't hate it. Like, what do you think?
I would not put anything past the Brewers. I really wouldn't. I think that it would make a lot of sense, especially when it comes to pitching. And again, like it wouldn't shock me if they went out and got Skubal. It wouldn't shock me if a team like the Rays went out and got Skubal. I mean, it's those kinds of teams that I'm watching more for guys like that. Because again, the Dodgers are the Dodgers. They'll always be there. They're always going to be in play. But I mean, when it comes to, I very long story short, I would say no, that's not a crazy thought. And it's something that I've actually kind of thought about. I'm like, ooh, the longer we go on, the more I could actually very much see this happening. And I think it would actually make a ton of sense for the Brewers.
Oh, totally. What he is so loved in that clubhouse. Like he was, yeah. If you spend any time around Freddie Peralta, you know he's one of the most positive people that you'll ever meet. And he had such an impact there. And his ties, I mean, he was there since he was a teenager. Like his ties there run deep. So I have a hard time seeing David Stearns doing something like that, because that'd be a tough pill to swallow. But still, like that'd be super fun. And that would get Milwaukee just totally just juiced up even more than it currently is. So again, I'm glad it wasn't I've had some pretty bad thoughts in this show, so I'm glad that wasn't one. So thank you for validating me. I appreciate you.
Anytime.
There you go. You're too good to me. But speaking of the trade market here, the Philadelphia Phillies, according to Bob Nightingale, continue to look for outfield help. They obviously swung a trade last week with the Chicago White Sox, bolstered their depth there a little bit. But is there anyone in particular on your end that you're eyeing up as maybe that could make some sense there?
Well, I think, you know, if you're Philadelphia, you want to look specifically at your biggest need, which is right field. Like you want, basically, if you're going to add outfield help, I think you need to add a right fielder who's going to directly replace Adolis Garcia without like requiring you to make any other major changes to your lineup. So, I mean, I think Bob Nightingale also mentioned these names, but I think they do make sense. Joe Adell and Seiya Suzuki. I think that, you know, differently in different ways, they would each make sense. I think Adell obviously has the upside. He has the team control. You know, his power numbers are down this year, but, you know, he's not striking out as much. And you know, he did just have the 37 homer season not that long ago. And I think that, you know, if the Phillies are looking at maybe a buy low candidate, you know, potentially he becomes a long-term outfield piece for them. And then, you know, on the other hand, if they're not looking long-term and they're thinking more immediate impact, I think Seiya Suzuki obviously is the more straightforward win now option. I think, you know, obviously he's a proven middle of the order bat. He's bounced back defensively in right field of late. I think that would give the Phillies an immediate offensive upgrade over what Garcia was giving them, and, you know, defensive kind of replacement. I think that, you know, he'd also probably cost less in terms of prospect capital since he's a pending free agent. So that's something to consider. I think that, you know, the common thread here, though, is just that they're both established right fielders. I think that allows Philadelphia to keep their center field mix intact, which is, you know, with Derek Hill and Justin Crawford, I think that you're not messing too much with the lineup there, and you are just directly filling the hole left by Garcia and his injury, which I think if you're the Phillies, that's the smarter thing to do right now.
No, totally. And they obviously those two names I think make a ton of sense. And I could be wrong. You may know this. The Suzuki, does he have a no trade clause? Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot there. But if he does, like, if he does, that could complicate things, but I think he does make a ton of sense for the Phillies for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if he does or not, but okay. That's fine. I think that I'm just looking at like more immediate impact, which that seems more like the type of move that the Phillies would make. But again, I don't know what his, you know, trade protection is, but I think it would make sense.
No, it would make plenty of sense. Like him, I think he'd make a lot of sense. And something that I've thought about too is last year they had a ton of success with getting Harrison Bader. Like he had a really strong time in Philadelphia. A lot of people there wanted him back. He wanted to be back in Philadelphia, and they did not bring him back. They signed Garcia instead. And obviously Bader ended up going to San Francisco. Signed multiple years. I don't know if that could be something that they try to go out and explore, but if they end up like not getting a Suzuki type or a Joe Adell type, I wonder if maybe a guy like Bader could be somebody. We see Abreu there mentioned in the comments. I could end up seeing him drawing plenty of interest at the deadline once again here. Thank you, ID_Money_16. Seiya Suzuki does indeed have a full no trade clause. So I was not imagining that. So we appreciate you big time. So that was very nice of you there. But also going back to Joe Adell, he is somebody who a ton of ability. He was a former top prospect, had a breakout season, 37 homers, like you said. Fantastic talent there. But the Angels have always seemed to place a high asking price on guys like that. So that could make things difficult. But Philadelphia and the Angels do have a history of making trades together, and especially with guys where the Angels have not been overly willing to move players. Brandon Marsh was somebody that the Angels for years had been getting asked about in trade talks. We're not willing to move him whatsoever. And the Phillies ended up giving up Logan Ohapi, which there was a video I ended up doing a couple years ago where I called that a steal for the Angels. And that has aged like a glass of milk. So that's a tough look for me. I stand by my takes. I know there's not too many people overall who do that. So, but I am indeed one of them. I stand by my takes, even though that does not look very good.
No, listen, I think, and I had a mentor in sports journalism who has told me that we say what we say because we see what we see. So, you know, whatever you say is accurate at the time based on what you're seeing. So I think, yeah, you stand by your take.
No, whoever that told you that, spot on, because I felt it. I was adamant about it. And that did not turn out to age very well. But you know what? That's okay. That's
we learn.
That's exactly it. Speaking of trades, we've been talking about the Astros as a team where Christian Walker could be available, Isak Paredes, like two of those guys. I've been throwing cold water on the Yordan Alvarez stuff. Like, I just do not see that happening. But they're only four games out of that division. Are we sure they're actually going to sell?
No.
Summed it up perfectly.
Yeah, no. To elaborate though, I would say they're what, 33-40 right now, give or take. I think that they're a couple games behind Seattle in a very soft AL West right now. I think that Dana Brown obviously has already said that he's not selling, or he doesn't envision them selling. I think, you know, unless things completely collapse again, because the division is so open, they have dealt with so many injuries this year. It's almost laughable how many injuries that they've had in Houston. And I think that, you know, they're not going to move any foundational pieces like Alvarez or Peña. I just don't see it happening. So I think that, you know, Houston is much more likely to either hold, like just stand pat, or maybe soft buy than sell, I think, just because, you know, they have all these guys who are coming back or already back from injuries. I mean, like Hunter Brown is due back, Josh Hader is back, Altuve's back. You know, you've got other guys who are rehabbing right now. So I think that that's the kind of context that if you're the front office, you're going to take that into consideration and say, you know, let's see what this looks like when we're fully healthy, rather than just strip it down.
Yeah. And they've been beat up by the injury bug more than almost anybody. It's been incredible. Like every time I would look at their injured list, it would be getting longer and longer and longer. And the names on that list were extensive. And like Uncle Ted's asking, I was like, why would Dana Brown sell a contract year? Did you see how bad they were to start the year? Like, that was like a genuine conversation that it wasn't just us having that conversation. It was everybody. And people were asking about Yordan Alvarez, like, could he be mentioned in trade talks? Again, like, he's going to be asked about, but there's no way he's going to be moved. And if they end up getting an offer for a Paredes type, or a Christian Walker, where last year, I think they would have been very eager to move on from him. And this year he's been much better. If you can end up getting value back for him, that would make a lot of sense. And also, like, a big offseason priority for them was shedding payroll. That's why they moved a guy like Dubon. It's why they moved some others. Maybe like moving on from that contract of a Walker or even a Hader could end up being enticing. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's a conversation that's worthy of having. But at this point, I think with them being so close, I don't know if it's, I'm with you. I don't know if that's necessarily the most likely thing in the world. That is true. They always do find a way to get in the playoffs despite slow starts. I will give you that, Uncle Ted. But lastly, before we wrap up the show, it seems like every single rundown that we're doing here, I got to mention Jacob Mizrowski and Yoshinobu Yamamoto. They have been simply unbelievable. And Mizrowski ends up throwing one of the best games, and actually the best game in Brewers history. Yamamoto almost throws a no-hitter the next day. Like, the state of the pitching in ball right now, Like, how crazy is it?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I was watching the Yamamoto perfect game bid at a sports bar while the World Cup was also happening. And I was the only person in that bar that was paying attention to the one TV that had the Dodgers game on, and everyone else was watching soccer. And I think when Mookie made the error, I yelled, like, I jumped out of my seat and everyone looked at me because nothing was happening in the soccer game. So I'm like, what is wrong with this girl?
But
I was like, nah, but I mean, it's insane. I think that, like, Mizrowski is making pitching just look impossible right now. It's like, who does that? 105, 6'7". I mean, that's ridiculous. But then I think on the other side of it, Yamamoto is making hitting look impossible. I mean, it's there's like kind of the violent dominance that Mizrowski has, and then the precise, like, surgical dominance that Yamamoto has. They're so very different from each other. And I do think that Yamamoto deserves a lot more Cy Young attention than he's getting, which sounds crazy to say that he's not getting a ton already, but I mean, he's looking close to elite. I think the hitting in the league right now, like you said, the pitching in the league right now is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we're all fortunate to be watching it.
No, we totally are. Mizrowski's been brilliant. It's shaping up to be one of the best Cy Young races of my lifetime, maybe ever. And I cannot wait to watch that. I cannot wait to break that all down with you even more going forward. So, Emma, appreciate you. Everyone in the comments, we appreciate you. Sean Daly, our lovely producer, we appreciate you. And we'll see you back here on Wednesday. Take care, everybody.